Welcome to the Pension Commission meeting. We have a quorum, and so we're going to begin for this long-awaited meeting. And I don't know if you expected us to jump into the issues that you've been waiting for so long to have come before us, but I thought it was important to, before we start or go on any further, when we had so many new members this year, I thought we should start off by reviewing the principles under which our legislation is supposed to be considered before we pass it. And I didn't get to do that early on. And so I thought that our first meeting during the interim, it would be a good opportunity to do that. And when I started, I knew it was a long time since, as a group, we've reviewed that. But I, when I started this position, I did go through my list of the Legislative Commission on Principles on Pension Policy, and I thought there were just a few pages there. And I thought that wouldn't take all that long, but then by the time we got through with the memo, there's 26 pages in addition. And so I thought, oh my gosh, we have a lot to do. We have a lot to review. But I think, as I read the memo, it pointed out some inconsistencies, but most important, it pointed out the history for all of us on where we were and what it lays it out for us to decide where we're going with the identification of how some of the legislation that we've passed is in agreement or disagreement with the principles that we've passed. And we don't want to do, we want to go forth and try to encourage our legislators, our friends and colleagues who talk about, I'm going to bring this pension bill up, to go through the principles and to see if indeed they are in what they're going to bring up in amendment or in bill form or to help their constituent really fits in with what we should be doing. And I think this is a good reminder. And with that introduction, Mr. Martin, do you want to give us some highlights of your memo, please?
Members, Representative Murphy wanted to review the principles of pension policy, and that document was formulated in 1995, 1996, and has not been thoroughly reviewed by the Pension Commission since that time. It developed, the policy principles developed over time. Once upon a time, the Pension Commission functioned as an interim commission between the biennial sessions of the legislature and had to provide a report to the legislature in which it recommended various changes for various legislative changes for the various public pension plans. And as part of that preparation of that formal document, sometime during the 60s, the Pension Commission started laying out policy principles, and those have been increased with the addition or modification of various principles over time until Representative Jefferson, as chair, undertook a thorough review of the policy principles and produced the document that you have currently. In my memo, what I've tried to do is in the 10 or 11 sessions since the policy principles were last thoroughly reviewed is to identify a number of instances where there are either direct problems or inconsistencies with the principles or at least nuanced differences between the principles or a particular reading of the principles and the way that the piece of legislation actually occurred. I don't know that going through the individual items per se would be terribly advantageous, but it's more to flag for you that there are a number of there are sometimes at least where the commission has done has recommended legislation which is not wholly consistent with the policy principles. Maybe just for purposes of demonstrating that, if you turn to page 4 of the memo, pages 3 and 4, the principle involved is that of creation of new pension plans. The policy principles suggest that, in summary, that we have a large number of pension plans already, and speaks strongly to not creating new pension plans. But on a couple of occasions, principally in 1999, there was the creation of a couple of new pension plans, the Fire Arson Investigator Retirement Plan, a small specialty plan run by the state retirement system, and a larger plan, the Local Government Correctional Employees Pension Plan, which is run by PERA. That would be an instance of inconsistencies with the policy principles. And those suggested or potential inconsistencies run for several pages page 11. On page 12, I've been starting in the balance of the memo, suggests some areas where there's been a lot of legislative action over time, but an area where the current policy principles seem to be silent or don't provide much guidance, and perhaps there ought to be contemplated new policy principles in that particular topic area. So that's the thrust of the memo. It's more of an attempt to provide some opportunity for thinking about the policy principles. Should you want to proceed in depth in taking a look at the principles.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The principles that we have before us were those adopted by the commission to help guide us so we can be consistent. Are there other areas, though, that are covered in statute that have adopted there, put in there, that we have to follow because they're in statute but might also be worth examining? And I'll give one example that comes to mind. We have a situation where some people are maybe they're in one plan, they're a state employee, but they also happen to be serving a city council. So they happen to be in two different plans, and what some individuals have had to do is as they retire from their state job, they wind up also leaving the city council only to turn around and be reappointed because they're required to get out of both of them. And I think that's in statute, not in the principle. But are there some things that, you know, probably we need to go back and double-check in statute that perhaps need updating or reconsideration?
Mr. Martin.
Senator members, there are a number of inconsistencies or instances where people can have problems, volunteer firefighters who are also public employees. There are no end of instances, especially with double coverage or coincidental coverage issues. Items more akin to the policy principles that I can think of are things that might be in Chapter 356. There's a provision that dates back to 1987 about no borrowing from public employee pension plans. It's more of a policy directive or a policy principle than it is a operative law, but it stands for the proposition that the legislature should not take assets out of public employee pension plans and use it for some other purpose. There are a few of those items, but in the main, we tend to not provide generalities in statute. We tend to limit the statutes to specific instances. Someone who's a certain age or in a certain occupation or has a certain length of service either can or can't do something. And there are instances where there are rubs. Last session, I think you had a bill, some former public employees who were employed by a medical examiner up in Anoka County who, because the county reacquired the medical examiner function, had a difference in their treatment, which caused them a rub based on what they were expecting. Those items tend to arise when people have the actual rub, and we tend to solve them as they occur. It would be somewhat difficult to try and speculate as to all the possible circumstances that could give rise to variable treatment under any given statute. It can be done, but I'm not sure, as compared to waiting for the problem to arise and solving it on a case-by-case basis, which has been the past commission practice, is probably the better way to go. One is more real, and the implications of the solution are easier to discern.
Madam Chair, it seems to me that if we obviously if we put something in statute and we have a case-by-case review as issues come up, that's one thing. If we wind up having a number of situations coming up and we say, well, this is what the statute says, you know, maybe we also have to examine what the statute says in addition to the principles that guide us. I don't know how many of those are out there. I thought of one area, but if there's others, I think the people who have an interest in these areas should call them to our attention. Not to change the law based upon one issue, but I think we should track or be mindful of the fact that maybe the principle set in statute may or may not be applicable in the future.
Good point. Is there any other comments or questions about Mr. Martin's remarks or the anything in the document? By any committee member?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just an overall question. I mean, there obviously the first couple of pages indicated sometimes where we have a principle and, you know, we've deviated from that. But then after that, there's a number of new issues that have been raised that simply are not covered by the principles. And Mr. Martin's
starting
memo,
on page 12.
Right. And Mr. Martin's memo indicated that if it's the desire of the commission that we should we could have further discussion on this. What would the staff be looking for from us as far as identifying those areas that we have to or moving ahead with some of those areas that just are not covered by, you know, by the current principles?
Mr. Martin?
Yes, Senator members, we could do it in one of two ways, depending upon how the commission wishes to proceed. You could do it as a formal interim topic that the entire commission participates in, or you could utilize the same method that Representative Jefferson, when he last undertook the review of the pension policy principles, did. He created a working group of any commission members who are interested in participating in the topic, as well as interested parties, and had that working group work through various topics and then presented a proposal to the Pension Commission for review later during the interim, and ultimately was adopted during the 96 session. What the staff would do, depending upon the direction we get, would be to work up an issues brief on each of the topics that you wanted to look at, trying to summarize the thinking that either in commentators from the outside or discussions that had occurred during our legislative sessions on the topic, whatever the broad policy confines of the given topic might be, we would lay out what has been done and what the best thinking seems to be on that particular topic, and then try and speculate as to how you could reduce that down to a policy principle, trying to promote thinking on the topic, and then the commission and interested parties could comment or suggest modifications thereafter.
Senator Lynch, Madam Chair, in addition to the items that would represent perhaps some new policy, there are also those 16 items that Mr. Martin referenced it in the beginning of his comments, and I guess I'd be interested in, of those 16, if there are particular ones that staff is recommending further study on. I noticed on a couple select ones, it says that this may indicate a need for further clarification or further study. Sometimes that was a comment on some of those items and not on some, and so I guess I'd like a little bit more counsel in that area.
Senator,
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Senator, members, probably the major topic that I would draw your attention to would be on page 6, the purchases of prior service credits. The commission over the past decade or decade and a half has seen an awful lot of proposed prior service credit purchases. The commission changed its prior principle or changed the adherence to the prior principle and principally in 1998-1999 when we permitted a large number of service credit purchases, in particular by teachers. Many of those were sunsetted on their face, and in some cases the sunset was extended, but a number of those have now expired. And so we have the circumstance where we had a principle which tended to require what was more confined in what service credit could be purchased. There was a general expansion of that authorization in the late 90s and early 2000s. Now many of those authorizations have expired, and it's somewhat difficult to know what policy you folks really want to pursue. And what we do with the policy principles is we try and flag for you in the commission staff issue memos where you're deviating or potentially deviating from established policy, and the whole prior service credit purchases issue is somewhat in flux, that it requires the payment of full actuarial value is about the only part of the prior principle that seems to be still applicable. Virtually any service, no matter how it's defined, has been purchasable by someone, but not necessarily everyone. And so that's an area, if I could point you to something where there have been a lot of instances where different legislation has been enacted, and an area where the staff is particularly at sea in trying to figure out how to advise you in whether you want to continue doing what has been the practice for the last 7, 8, 9 years. Probably the other area I could look to would be on page 9, towards the bottom, item 14, how to handle pension coverage for privatized public employees. There have been a number of models for handling privatized employees over the years. The most predominant way of handling this circumstance now is to place the privatized public employee either in Minnesota statutes chapter 352E or 353E. These are the privatized employee laws for MSRS and PERA, which give them an enhanced deferred annuity and keeps them eligible for a rule of 90 our retirement. But on some occasions, we've had instances where public employees who are being privatized were retained in the pension fund as full members of the pension plan for future service. Instances of that, there was a Red Wing school district set of employees down in Red Wing where they were an environmental learning center that was a nonprofit corporation, had been historically considered to be members of the school district until it was determined that they weren't, but they were retained in TRA anyway. There was a governmental training agency that was privatized that was retained in state retirement system coverage or PERA coverage, I forget which, 4 or 5 years ago. So there have been instances where we, notwithstanding we normally separate privatized public employees from future public sector pension plan coverage, we've not always done that, and that's another area where there has been different resolutions without a whole lot of clarity. So it makes it difficult for us to try and advise you when you've deviated from this somewhat inconsistent practice. And maybe a third one would be question of amortization dates. This would be on the bottom of page 10, top of page 11. The commission has reset some amortization dates on a case-by-case basis without necessarily a lot of clarity as to what the driving principle is, and it may be a good idea to revisit the issue of what's the appropriate amortization date, or at least how that date ought to be reset periodically. So those would be a couple of areas.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a question of Mr. Martin, and if the answer is contained within the staff memo, excuse me, I'll have missed it. But the first portion of the memo lists several principles of pension policy. It's chosen a period of time, about 10 years between 97 and 2007, and in discussing several of the principles of pension policy, Mr. Martin, you've listed several examples of recent legislation during that 10-year period that, to you, suggest a potential departure from those policy principles. I counted roughly 67 items of legislation you're looking at during those 10 years. During that same period of time, how many items of legislation did we deal with that adhered to and complied with our pension policy?
Representative, I did not try and do a body count in either case. The method that I used in trying to design the memo was to go through the session summaries for the past 11 sessions and walking through them to flag what seemed to be a departure, and literally just cut it out of the document. And that gives me a rough sense of how much was where we had departures and a rough sense of when there were not departures. My sense was that there were less departures than there were departures. There was more uncut pages left on my desk after I got done than there were items cut out of the session. So, but it was not far from a 50-50 proposition, probably closer to 60-40. So an adherence in about 60% of the circumstances and a departure in maybe 40% of cases.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Maybe one point on that question. If you can quantify and get a precise number of items of legislation that did adhere during that same time to policy, if it turns out to be 60-40, I guess my point is, if I have a point, rather than viewing 67 items where we've departed from policy and then deciding to throw up our hands and conclude that we've overstepped the bounds and we have to rein ourselves in or change the policy or whatever, maybe actually our policies are working if we have many more times over adhered to our policies in dealing with items of legislation. Yeah, in looking at the items where we varied, maybe we can conclude that we must make some changes to govern ourselves. But then again, maybe this is not a red flag. I'm raising the question.
I think that's a good point, Representative Smith. And also, probably we wouldn't be considering the legislation, the proposed legislation, in some cases, if we had a principle. So maybe legislation that's outside of the principles gets introduced more often because we don't have a past practice or because the funds don't have past practice on that. So,
Madam Chair, that's a good point.
Yeah. Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Two issues. One is the prior service issue when we're listing all of the extensions for which prior services can be granted. Perhaps we should have some discussion of that with respect to what is good or fair public policy. Like, for example, I'm particularly, I think it to consider maternity leave as a prior service, I think, is a particularly family-friendly action that we clearly should take. The other question I have is that, and it's unclear to me from reading under what circumstances we require full actuarial payment and under what circumstances we don't. And so I'd like to know how we're consistent on that. And then I'd like to know, is there any disadvantage to these expansions is if we require full actuarial service? And then the other comment that I'd like to make on the teachers' issue is that one of the arguments for extending it beyond the connection to Minnesota was the ability, particularly in needed subjects, to recruit teachers from other places if this was could be part of the offer. So I'd just kind of like to I don't know if we need to revisit this whole issue, if we need to do it by law or by policy or what, but I'd like some question on that, and maybe even starting, is the expansion in any ways detrimental to the pension plans, and is it always done at full actuarial value? That's the first question.
Good. Anything else from the commission at this time? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to comment or respond in any way to the memo or to the topic of the principles? Or is there anyone that has an idea that we really should go forth and study something different or make a change in any of the principles? Please come down. Mr. Lara, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Renee Lara with Education Minnesota. The one point that we would want to add to the conversation is the suggestion that the guiding principles take into account some of the needs arising from particularly in regards to among our membership, recent retirees who are educators whose benefits are not keeping up with inflation, and the retirees, the future retirees who are now fairly younger, the two-thirds of our school employees who do not qualify for the rule of 90. I know that is in the realm of statutory development, and you are looking simply at the guiding principles. But in laying out the groundwork and the framework in which to discuss any possible legislation that we suggest to you and ask you to consider the needs of many of our members who have not benefited from previous investments, good times, especially in the 90s. Our younger population of school employees are simply looking at benefits that rank below other states in most respects. And in fact, the only area in which they are near the average is in terms of their employee contribution. But in terms of benefits that they're looking forward to, rank fairly low. And you've probably seen this ranking of states that we've passed before. We formatted it in an easier-to-read manner, so we hope that maybe this might be easier to read, and I'll pass these out for you. And that is our one suggestion as you develop these guiding principles that lay the groundwork and the framework in which you discuss pension policy. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Bethel.
Madam Chair, just on that particular point, it seems to me that maybe the current principles do address that situation. I'm looking at 2C, I guess 3 and 4, equal treatment within pension plans and then appropriate normal retirement ages. Just within that one plan, I mean, there are some people who have the rule of 90, some people do not. Some people can retire at an earlier age because of the rule of 90, some people have to keep working. So I don't know that needs to be the principles, you know, need to be adjusting. It's just that we need to look at the public policy that does not fit our principles here.
Mm-hmm. And another issue that I know has caused me angst as we've considered various legislative proposals has been the survivor benefits, and that's listed on page 21, number 10. And I think I still want to think about that some more. And so this has given us a good start in relationship to the principles and a good review of the principles. And so I noticed that on the agenda, it was first consideration. So as a commission, and why don't we think about this for a few days and mull it over and see if there's any particular item in the memos that each person individually wants to explore a little more and think about a little more and possibly decide if you want to make a recommendation or a working group for that particular item. And think about the ones that we've already circled or paid attention to in our discussion today. And so we can get assignments at the next meeting or offer our service for a particular item by the next meeting. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Madam Chairman, I'd also like to bring up an issue which came before us, and I don't remember what we finally did with it, except I think Representative Nelson put in a bill because he understood the issue among us. On page 26, the retirement coverage values after marriage dissolution, and this is the issue of, and I should yield to Representative Nelson, who understands the issue, but he did put in a bill on what's happening. This is the issue that the fallback position would be that it is divided, and it's and it's incumbent on the you know, instead of having the spouse who tends to be trying to think of a nice way to say messed up by this, not used street language in discussing this, it would be assumed that the spouse would get it instead of the other way around.
Right.
Mike, do you want to?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You know what I'm talking about.
And that's the bill I had in dealing with with the it'd be an automatic or it'd be the assumption that it'd be a 50% survivor for life for the spouse at retirement, and they'd have to opt for other options other than that if and sign off on it instead of the bills that we keep coming. We've seen a couple of them where the member dies and then the spouse is left with nothing, and this way they at least they'd have 50% of the pension. I think that's just good policy so that we're not having to look at these every time mm-hmm. they jump up. That would be make us consistent, and it's part of the other memo, and I was
okay.
paging through it, consistent with federal ERISA laws.
Right.
Madam Chair, just as far as going forward, I think it's quite clear that you know we have not reviewed these principles in over 10 years, and so we're overdue, and I think the staff has certainly come up with a number of areas that either we've been inconsistent or some new areas that just are not covered by them. So I think it's quite clear we're probably going to have to spend some time doing this. Now, what shape or form it comes, whether it's a working group or the full commission, I don't really have any thoughts on at this time, but I certainly do support proceeding with further consideration mm-hmm. of this topic.
And I think what I'd like each of us to think about in particular is if there's one thing or two things in this that you are particularly interested in exploring, then that could pretty well, if we each one of us took one or two things, that could pretty well address the whole until the next time we reviewed it. But I also keep in mind with what Representative Smith brought out that when Mr. Martin was doing his cutting, the pack of materials that were where we didn't go astray at all was a lot higher than the other pack it was. And, you know, sometimes I think just the fact that I mean, so many times, so many times when someone's talked to me about pension things, I've asked the person, I said, before you go any further, please review the principles by which we're guided. And at least a third of the cases, I don't see that person again. And that's a good thing. And so these principles serve their purpose very well. And I think the guideline that we have to have is perhaps stricter than theirs, but this is a good working document, and it is serving us well. And we can always say, well, where is that? Where is that in the principles of what someone might be asking? I think another thing that has come up in recent years is that people are all tied up when they're talking about pensions. They're so often they're angry about the pension plan or their about their plan that they're in, and really what they're angry about is their health insurance policies, not their pension policy. But when retirement comes or when there's a death, the two things get combined so much, and we've got to keep that in mind too and clarify that what's pension policy when people are talking to us, what's pension policy and what's their health policies under their contract, not their pension plan. So, Representative Kahn.
Well, it's a little off this topic, so if we're still on this topic. But, I'd like to bring up two issues related to the Pension Commission's operations. One, I know it's a frustration, and we've just kind of routinely assumed now that the pension bills will go through Rules Committee instead of and ignore all committee deadlines. But the one of the issues would be to get a system in place similar to what when I was on at LCM Mar had of doing the work before the session starts and having a deadline for the introduction of pension bills that's different from the regular one, and looking at what things cannot be, you know, it's obviously a difficulty when you have an election and you have new members and that sort of thing. But looking at the things that really can't be postponed until the next year, and saying that we'll do our major work out of the legislative session. The next thing would be is to have the Pension Commission recognized as an entity in state government that gets its scheduled time from both the House and the Senate, so that we have a time that's looked into when other things are being put together. And then the third thing, which I've convinced the House of several times, is I would like to see expansion of the Pension Commission's membership. And that, just to review this, I've proposed this many times. The House has passed it several times, the option to go to 7 members instead of 5, just to get a few more people in the legislature. Well, the one thing would be to get immediately another minority member on the Pension Commission, particularly important when, which I hope isn't going to happen soon, but when control of the houses change, it's really nice to have a couple of people who've had I don't want to encourage that, but I do want to recognize that it's happened a couple of times at least since I've that's maybe why the Senate doesn't understand it, because it's a foreign concept. Change of control is a foreign concept to the Senate. But but just having more people in the legislature who understand this, so we don't have... I know none of us like it when we have a person whom we want to be really sympathetic to coming before us, and, you know, we're the people who have to say no. And it would be nice if more people understand why we have to say no.
And we could let the minority persons say no.
Okay. Well, we understand. And then the history, I'll just say a little bit about the numerics of the history that shows that a compromise can sometimes be worse than what you when the House proposed 7 and the compromise 1 year was 6. 6 turned out to be the worst possible number, because we increased the members of the Pension Commission in each house by 1, but we also increased the quorum by 1. So it became unbelievably more difficult to get a quorum. 7 is a much better number, because 7 increases the number by 2, but it only increases the quorum number by 1, so it's easier to get a quorum, something that was never realized until we saw the practice of 6. So I'd like to I'd like to see this increase to 7, and I'd like to see, you know, maybe it's just Senator Betzolt I have to convince, but because I know when we were dealing with this in the government operation and the State Government Finance Conference Committee report, I know that members of that conference committee were sympathetic to that, but I wish I ever got that deference to the chair, but we're very deferential to the opinion of the chair.
Well, Senator Betzel. I'm very reasonable, but I don't think my other conferees were quite there yet either. So.
Oh, okay. I'd like it to be on the topic of discussion.
Yeah, okay. as for meeting times, of course, we're locked in right now. The meeting times we've got for this last session are going to be the same ones for the next session. I expect that we can certainly have interim hearings over the next few months, and we can talk about spillover issues like St. Paul teachers and other things that really have to be resolved. But, boy, if people keep introducing bills right up until deadline time, and we do have until the second deadline to put our bill together, but the trouble is when things kick in gear during the session, it is really tough to get the pension bill going. We've done the best we can with the little time we've had over recent years, but I don't know how I can tell colleagues to quit introducing bills, because they're going to do that.
Well, what
if they don't, they'll do amendments.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little, you know, I guess I'd like it before a session, but what if we said that the policy made it as a Pension Commission policy, that our work will be done before the session and in the interim, and only in an extreme emergency will any legislation be considered if it hasn't been introduced in that period of time. Because we know, and that you will then have the additional hurdle of showing why it can't be laid over for the next, to meet that next pre-session deadline, or make it 1 week into the session, or something like that. I mean, obviously, it's everyone's freedom to introduce the bill, but we don't have to hear them. Mm-hmm. It's our freedom to make that determination.
We certainly could encourage them to get their bills done now and
I'm thinking of
considered in October, November, December. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I presume that we could, as a commission or the chair, could establish a earlier deadline, even if it's earlier in the session. I think logistically it's going to be difficult for us to complete our agenda before the end of the year, because I think it just means we're going to have to revisit everything after we're back into session. Every other year is an election year for the House, and there is going to be turnover, or issues, perspective on issues may change given the outcome of the election. And so I don't know that there's an easy way to solve it. But it does seem to me that we could potentially provide for an earlier deadline that is in advance of the first deadline for committees, although, as Senator Betzold and I have been talking offline here, every bill is an emergency for its author, and that's going to be a challenge probably for us that we can't fix. But that it seems to me that would be one way, is for us to have and maybe part of this, I think, is after elections, getting leadership to make membership decisions
before March 15th.
Before March 15th, much more quickly. I think that's especially important for this commission, because we do so much work that needs to also go through the rest of the process.
We did,
or Representative Kahn.
We did fix it, which used to be just awful, that the membership continues, doesn't it? It does continue until replaced. So we got rid of that hurdle, at least. Didn't we?
We did that, but nobody called a meeting.
Oh.
So it didn't
we can't
have any effect.
The membership
doesn't. Any positive effect.
But it used to cancel.
Right.
It used to stop. So,
is there any other suggestions for future items of study during the interim? Or future things that you want to talk about during the interim that's not probably going to happen? Representative Kahn.
Well, I'd like to bring up the issue of the that was brought up earlier this year, when the actuary for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association advised the commission that the mortality tables for the Minneapolis Police Pension Fund were not accurate and were out of date. And I can't believe that this is the only fund for which that's true, although it may be the ones that it's the worst off. So I think we need to look at this issue, because it's clear that people are living longer, and the last time it was updated was nearly 30 years ago.
And it's my understanding they've prepared history that's ready to be presented to the commission.
I guess we've updated some of them, but we haven't updated that one.
Right.
And as I see, it's a violation of the principles that we even have that fund, but that's another. I don't know if we're prepared to go there.
It's all tied together, right?
I don't know if we're prepared to go there at that point. The existence of a couple of these funds, most of them seem to be Minneapolis funds, so I apologize. But the existence of a fund that's been allowed to continue even with declining membership is a self-solving problem.
And it's
we may
over.
Want to revise the mortality tables, but we haven't solved the problem of mortality.
And it goes back to 18-something, 1890-something, or 1885, or so that it predated the legislative commission.
Okay.
Senator Larson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would concur with Representative Kahn as it relates to that. Really is an issue, I think, that we have to address. But then it's probably also one that we should think about as it relates to our principles as well, and making sure that as, things like mortality rates change, that we're, across the board using the most responsible statistics for our funds. But I think in terms of the Minneapolis fund, it probably is something that would be good for us to take a look at before the end of the year.
Good. Any other suggestions?
Sorry.
Representative Kahn.
Going to regret putting me on this committee. The issue that I've also been working on for years and years and that we seem to make some progress but never quite get there is the consolidation of the volunteer firefighter funds and looking at the those funds. And I think that one of the worst examples, and this is something that doesn't even come to the issue of a state problem because it's not a state problem, is the volunteer firefighter funds that have a defined contribution plan rather than a defined benefit plan. So there's no state liability and there's no local liability and have a terrible investment policy. And so we're just, again, I keep wanting to use these street terms, which I'll refrain from doing, but it's just the individual members that are getting stuck with something that we never see. And I had tried to make some of this more public, but I think that effort has just hoping that people would just see this and we get an uprising from the ranks, but that hasn't worked. It hasn't worked to make the returns more public. And I'd like to see, with email now, I'd like to see much more stuff going on the Internet. And I don't know, at first I thought that the state auditor's office was going to be cooperative in that, but they got nervous about it. So I'd like to look at us requiring returns to be done by computer and submitted that way and give the aid to the people who can't do it. I think all you need to do is give them the rate that you'd pay a smart high school student and it could and it could all get done. So I'd like to see us. I'd like to look at that. And I know, I don't know if Niall Zuckman is here, but I know they've been working on it on a kind of a voluntary issue, and I'd like to see if it works in a voluntary issue. But I'd sure like to have us put some clout behind us to get good investment, to get some of these plans that have just no investment expertise out of the investment business.
Right. Very good. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you get down the joint survivor? Is that on your list there, the joint survivor benefit?
Yes.
Okay.
That's circled. That's from the memo.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Page 26, was it?
Madam Chair, page 26 is dealing more with divorce and dissolution of marriage as opposed to the issue of joint survivor benefit for a surviving spouse.
Okay.
Page 19 would be more pertinent. Item number 8.
Page 19.
Members, in connection with Representative Nelson's piece of legislation, his bill would provide that instead of an automatic single life annuity, there would be an automatic joint and survivor annuity with the opportunity to reverse that. And that's more what we had in mind with new potential issue number 8,
yeah.
Okay. The optional annuity types.
Very good. Anything else for item number 1 or item number 3? If not, we're on item number 2, then. We welcome the legislative auditor to discuss and present the report of the post-employment benefits for public employees report.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Jody Hauer, who was the manager of our evaluation of post-employment benefits for public employee report, which I think you've all had an opportunity to look at during the legislative session. Madam Chair, I think the discussion that you've just had about a number of issues is very relevant to what we're going to talk about. I would first just mention, in follow-up to Representative Kahn's point, that we did also, in a separate report, evaluate volunteer firefighter pension funds and would be happy to come back at some later date and present that to you, because I think there are a lot of issues, and Representative Kahn has really shown a great deal of interest in that report and a lot of leadership on that issue, and I know it's one that concerns a lot of you as well. So at another day, possibly. Today, we'd like to talk about parts of this report. Now, as you know, the Legislative Audit Commission gives us our agenda in the Office of the Legislative Auditor for evaluations each year. And this is an issue that they gave us, I think, largely because there was increased concern about a lot of the growing liabilities in local governments, particularly, for extending health care coverage beyond employment into post-employment as a benefit. And there's been a lot of attention on the situation in Duluth. But the legislature, the Legislative Audit Commission, wanted a more comprehensive examination of that. We're not really going to talk about that today, but if you have questions, we'd be happy to answer them. We want to come to the issue that we talked about that is very relevant to this commission and I think of great interest to you, and that's the post-employment retirement fund. And we really raised, I think, two important issues about that fund. One, I think, has already been dealt with during the legislative session, and that was simply the way the deficit was being reported. And in examining the post fund, we found that actually this commission had actuarial standards that we thought should be changed. You had standards that essentially told the actuary to equate liabilities with assets. And that is not consistent with generally accepted accounting principles. We talked to a number of you during the legislative session about that issue, and legislation was enacted which directs the commission to have actuarial standards for the valuation of the post fund that are consistent with generally accepted accounting principles. And so I think that issue is settled, although you may want to talk about it, and we'll certainly mention in the presentation today. The other issue, frankly, is much more complicated and difficult, and that is what to do about the deficit in the post fund. And as you hear our presentation today, and Ms. Howard's also going to talk about some issues with particularly one of the local pension funds as well, but specifically on the post fund, I'd like to say a word because, Madam Chair, you invited the audience to suggest the possibility that you might want to adopt some additional principles that are not currently, as I understand it, in your list of principles. And I would commend to you considering the possibility of adopting as a principle that defined benefit plans should not have benefits tied to investment performance. I think that's a fairly fundamental principle that most people recognize and agree with. But you, the legislature, departed from that in years past, I think in part because many public employees came to you and said, as was just said, that benefits are not adequate for some retirees. And with a large investment return, they advocated that they tie some of their benefits to investment performance. That really is a fundamental conflict with the concept of the defined benefit plan. It's sort of confusing what that plan is that most public employees have. And so you did that in the past, and it created a number of problems. First of all, it created a very significant deficit. But also it created some inequities that you're now hearing about again, that some people in the 90s got very significant increases because you tied part of their benefit to investment performance. And because now there's a deficit, other employees, other retirees are not getting that benefit, and they feel like there is an inequity. We know that it is going to be very difficult for all the parties concerned, including the legislature, to work your way out of this diversion from the principle of what is a defined benefit plan and to decouple from investment performance. But as you listen to the problems that have been created because of that diversion from that principle, I think you might agree that that's something you will want to consider. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to turn to a presentation of our report from Ms. Hauer, if I could. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Ms. Hauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Commission, I am Jody Hauer with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm going to take some time today to describe the parts of this report that have to do with state and local government pensions. We issued this back in January this year, and, of course, changes have occurred since that time. The pension bill was passed. Some economic circumstances have changed over that time, and I'm going to try to point out some of those changes in conjunction with what we have in the report as we go along. Overall, in our work on Minnesota's pensions, we found some large problems with the post-retirement fund. Now, as members of this commission, you all know that the post-retirement fund is not a separate public pension plan. What it is a pool of the resources that come as assets from the statewide pension plans when one of those members retires. We saw that as of July of 2006, that post-retirement fund had a deficit of $4 billion. Now, the financial reports for this year, for fiscal year 2007, have not yet been completed, so we don't know what the changes are from that point when we were looking at them last year. We understand the deficit is now expected to be somewhere between $2 and $3 billion, although, as I said, the data haven't been finalized. You also realize, I'm sure, that any reduction in the size of the deficit is something that, between last year and this year, is based entirely on investment performance. And at any given day, that can change. Markets can go up, but, of course, markets can also come down. Well, we also found problems with the post fund in terms of the formula that's used to calculate increases to benefits for retirees. There are a couple of problems there. First of all, that formula does not protect the post fund from deficits. Secondly, it does not align the benefit increases with inflation, nor does it treat retirees equitably. And I'm going to talk about each of these in turn. First, we looked at what's reported to be the financial status for the statewide pension plans that are administered by the Public Employees Retirement Association, the Teachers Retirement Association, and the Minnesota State Retirement System. So we looked at those statewide plans' funding ratios, which, again, as you know, is a measure of the fund's assets to the liabilities. We found that the funding ratios used in the actuarial valuations to report the financial status make those funds appear to be better funded than they really are. Now, the funding ratios are misleading because they don't properly value the assets of the post fund. Assets are supposed to be valued on the basis of a market-related value, according to the accounting principles that are set up for governmental agencies. But the value of the post fund assets are not market-related. And instead, actuaries assume that the assets equal the liabilities, as Jim Nobles has just pointed out, even though, as of last year, July 2006, assets were actually $4 billion less than the liabilities for the post fund. And they do that in large part because the existing Pension Commission actuarial standards require actuaries to set the post fund assets equal to the estimated liabilities. Again, though, as Jim Nobles pointed out, a provision in the 2007 Omnibus Pension Bill now prohibits the Pension Commission actuarial standards from containing any kind of evaluation requirement that's inconsistent with generally accepted accounting principles. When we looked at the actuarial valuations for the statewide plans, we looked at the amount of their unfunded liabilities, their deficits, as well as the funding ratios. And the table on this slide now shows what the financial status was, again, as of July 2006, for the three largest of the statewide pension plans. All of them had deficits. If you look at, for instance, at row one here, the largest deficit was $4.2 billion for the PERA's Public Employees Retirement Plan. That plan also had the lowest funding ratio at 75%. But even with the deficits that each of these plans had, all of them were reportedly on track to become fully funded by certain dates that are set out in statute. That's in part due to changes that were made back in 2005 and 2006. The legislature during those years increased the amount of contributions that will be paid by employers and employees in order to bring those pension plans up to full funding. And the final column in this particular table shows those dates by which those plans are expected to be at 100% funding. Now, the problem with the funding ratios and the actuarial studies is that they only give us a part of the story. We don't hear the full story. The market value of the post-fund assets is not used in calculating those funding ratios. As a result, those funding ratios that are reported make those funds appear to be better funded than they actually are. Now, this table shows what the funding ratios were as reported in the actuarial valuations and what they might be if those post-fund assets were included as a part, or the deficit was included as part of the funding ratio. Again, I'll point you to the first row there, PERA's Public Employees Retirement Plan. The funding ratio as reported in the actuarial valuation was at 75%. But if that plan's part of the post funds deficit were included, that funding ratio would actually decline from 75% down to 68%. I feel compelled, though, to point out that these numbers are, again, as of July 2006. Things have changed since last year. We know that. If, as some people are expecting now, the funding ratios for the active funds have improved since that over the last year, and if the post funds deficit has actually diminished somewhat in the succeeding year, the gap between the reported funding ratios and the revised funding ratios also could be diminished. But again, we aren't going to know that until we have the final numbers for fiscal year 2007. Now, even before this legislative year, the legislature had made some important changes that affect the statewide pension funds, but none of these changes affect that deficit in the post fund. The 2006 legislature passed a 5% cap on increases to retirees' benefits. That cap will take effect in 2010. That cap will be helpful in that it will help prevent future deficits, but it's not going to help us with the current deficit. As I mentioned already, in 2005 and 2006, the legislature passed increases to the contributions that we made to the active funds from both employers and employees for most of these pension plans. And these will help bring those plans up to full funding by certain target dates that are set out in statute. But we have to remember that those contributions are for active members of the plans. They're not for the retirees. Those are assets for the active funds, and they will have no effect on the assets in the post fund. So none of these changes, although they are important in and of themselves, none of them will correct that deficit in the post fund. Now, besides this problem with the deficits, we point out in our report several other problems having to do with the formula that's used to increase benefits for retirees after they've retired. The first is that the formula helps to create the deficit that's now in the post fund. Jim Noble's already pointed this out in his opening remarks. The formula increases the benefits now when investment returns are high. Those increases become permanent. But it doesn't reduce benefits when investment earnings are poor. By not retaining enough during the good years to offset those bad years, the formula puts the fund at risk for developing significant deficits, and that's where we find ourselves today. Now, Minnesota's pensions are, of course, defined benefit pension plans, and the benefits are supposed to be independent of market performance, but the formula was not structured accordingly. The second problem we point out in the report is that the benefit increases have not been well aligned with inflation. You all know this, but I'll just remind you, there are two components to the formula that's used to increase retirees' benefits. The first is an inflation component, and that's capped at 2.5%. The second component is based on market performance. So if the post fund has a funding ratio of at least 100%, it has to be fully funded. If the markets are strong and investment returns exceed the amounts needed to pay retirees' benefits, then benefits will increase. But as this graph shows you on this particular slide, the increases have not been well aligned with inflation. I'll point out in particular the gap that exists between 1997 and about 2001, and you'll see that the benefit increases during that period of time exceeded inflation from 3 to 9 percentage points. The third problem that we point out with the formula is that it created large inequities between cohorts of employees. The value of the benefits for some retirees, those who retired back in the 1990s, grew far more than for those who retired after 2000. And one of the reasons is that the benefit increases for retirees increased on an annual basis 9.2% every year from 1996 through 2001. So those who had retired by that time, of course, reaped those benefits. But employees who retired after July 1st of 2001 have seen increases of only 2.5% or even less every year. And they're going to continue to receive only 2.5% increases as long as the post fund has a deficit. Well, we have three recommendations related to the post fund. Again, as Jim Noble's already pointed out, one of those we think has been already corrected by action of the 2007 legislature. That recommendation was that the legislature should require that the funding ratios for PERA, TRA, and MSRS retirement plans reflect the true condition of the post fund. And the provision was included in that omnibus pension bill to correct that problem. Second, we recommend that the legislature develop a plan that would fully fund the post-retirement fund. And we lay out some options for ways to do that, although in our report we don't suggest one over another. There are difficulties with all of them. There isn't an easy solution. But concurrently, we think that the legislature should change that formula for benefit increases, replace the investment-based component, replace it with an enhanced inflation component. We think it's important to make those changes together as a package because then they stand a much better likelihood of being accepted by retirees, employees, and employers. Now, you may already know that there's a joint post-fund committee of the three statewide pension associations. This joint post-fund committee has been meeting since January, and it's been dealing with these very issues related to the post-fund, and I believe that's going to be part of your discussion as you go along. Finally, I have some words about local pension funds. Of course, the local pension funds in Minnesota are on a much different scale than the statewide funds, but we did have some findings here. Minnesota has seven of these local pension funds, and of these, we found that the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund is the one at risk for serious funding problems in the near term. The St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund had a $420 million deficit as of July of 2006. It had a 69% funding ratio, and the contributions for the plan are far below what are needed to bring that plan up to full funding by its target date, which is 2021 right now. The primary factors in the financial condition for the St. Paul Teachers Fund are inadequate contributions to that plan over many years, over decades, the stock market decline since 2001, and substantial post-retirement benefit increases made to retirees in the late 1990s and early 2000s. We think that the legislature should reduce the risk for future problems with the local pension plans, and our recommendations are to first disallow investment-based increases when those funds have large deficits. You know, up to now, for both the St. Paul and the Duluth teacher retirement funds, they get an automatic 2% increase every year, and then an investment-based increase any year that there's where the five-year average return exceeds 8.5%. Now, these investment-based increases went on even when those funds had large deficits. So even though St. Paul's Teachers Retirement Fund had large deficits, it continued to give those investment returns when those criteria were met. The second recommendation we had is that the legislature consider replacing that investment component for the formula for the local teachers' funds and then replace it with one that's based on inflation. We think that for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund in particular, the legislature should also consider increasing contributions for that fund. Now, the 2007 legislature did make some changes here. It passed a temporary inflation-based formula for the St. Paul Teachers Fund specifically, and it required a study of more permanent adjustments to those retiree benefits. So with that, I'll summarize what our findings were related to pensions. We found that Minnesota statewide pensions appear to be better funded than they really are because they don't reflect that deficit in the post fund. Recent changes made by the legislature were important, but they're not going to address that deficit. And we found that the St. Paul Teachers Fund does face some funding problems. To sum up our recommendations regarding the post fund, the legislature should require that the statewide pension plans reflect the true financial status of the post-retirement funds, something on which the 2007 legislature has already acted. We recommend that the legislature plan to fully fund that post fund and change the investment-based component of the formula to increase benefits. Again, something that this joint post-fund committee of the statewide pension associations is starting to, it has been dealing with this year. And then finally, regarding the local teachers' pension plans, we recommended changing that post-retirement benefit increase formula and considering increased contributions to improve the St. Paul Teachers Fund's financial health. So with that, Madam Chair, I conclude my remarks. We'll answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Auer. Questions? Senator Betzel. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just make an observation. Back on slide 7, when we compared inflation to benefit increases, I don't know that it has happened or it's possible to every year come in and say, okay, what's inflation? Let's make adjustments to the benefits accordingly, because people are probably not going to be happy with that. They would like to keep track with inflation, but if inflation is low, they may also want higher benefit increases. And I think there was some sort of a correlation because we had a really spike in inflation in the early 80s,
And sure enough, a few years later, we increased the benefits. That was before my time, of course, but I suspect I was certainly here in the late 90s, and I remember the arguments that saying, well, we lost so much of our power, our buying power, because our retirement checks haven't kept up with inflation, therefore you got to do a lot of catching up to do. And we did that. And the other argument was, oh, by the way, the stock market is doing well. We're doing, you know, this is going to go on forever, so why not bump us up some more too? So I think those are the problems we get caught in. We do try to play catch-up, and we do try to anticipate the future, and sometimes we guess right, and I think many times we guess wrong, but I don't know of a good way to line up all the economic factors and then tie the benefit increases to them, because I don't know that that's a satisfactory one either, but I think we do need to be – I think we have done some good things in trying to cap off the benefit increases so that we just don't say, well, we've got more coming in, let's give it all away. And so I think we've gone on the right track, but none of that solves a future thing. But it does require some discipline, and unfortunately we get turnover on this commission, and you know the arguments keep coming over regardless of who's sitting here. And it sounds good. Oh, let's get caught up on inflation. Oh, we got money, let's spend it. And those are issues that are going to go on for a long time.
Ms. Howard, I had a question on slide 9 where you said that we should introduce an enhanced inflation component. Like what?
Well, Madam Chair, there are a number of things that could be done. And you'll probably hear about some of those when you hear an update of the work of this joint post fund committee, because they have been dealing with that. But there are ways to look at, one of these things is now being considered by that joint post fund committee, to look back at those, look back in time for those who did not enjoy enough of an increase to actually offset inflation. But in those years where inflation is fairly low and there are revenues available, to increase the amount of the benefit for those particular retirees so that there is some catch-up for them. That's one possibility. There are other ways that can be done. Again, I don't think any of them is an easy solution, but there's a variety of mechanisms out there that could be used to enhance what's now capped at the 2.5% each year for inflation.
Okay. So you think that it's a possibility that some individuals could get an enhancement, so to speak, whereas others wouldn't within the same plan?
Madam Chair, that's certainly a possibility. That's not. I don't think that we should limit our discussion to that. I think that there, in other years where the inflation has risen substantially, certainly the amount of the benefit increase should track with that. Now, we can't. I don't think that the pension plans would ever say that they can entirely compensate for every inflationary increase. There might be a year where inflation is, you know, 6% or whatever, and they wouldn't have sufficient funds to be able to give a benefit increase to all of the retirees to compensate for that amount of an inflationary increase. Nonetheless, in that year, we would say that the amount of the inflation component should be greater than 2.5%, which is where it's now capped.
And, Madam Chair, if I could just also amplify on that, because I think, again, thinking about interim projects for the commission, I think this is one that bears a lot of attention, because it would take us back to the principle that the state has guaranteed, has promised to retirees that they will receive a defined benefit, but that the state will protect them against costs of living increases to the best that can be done. And it may not be perfect, but if we work on that and try to improve on that, I think we stand a better chance legally and politically of decoupling the defined benefit plans from investment performance. I mean, we may never find a perfect solution, but what we do know is that what we've done in the past has created significant problems by coupling benefits to investment performance. As I said before, it is a diversion from the basic fundamental principle of what a defined benefit plan is. It creates inequities that we point out in our report, but that you hear from people who are sitting in the audience. So I think the point here is to learn a lesson from what has gone well and what is not. And the way the post fund has been handled, I think, shows us that we've got some problems that we need to correct, and we've seen some roads that we don't want to continue to go down. So focus on finding the best way to protect retirees from cost of living increases. It won't be perfect, but at least you won't have these gyrations that come with tying benefits in part to investment performance.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I would like to point out that there was a less harmful way of tying benefits to investment performance, and that was the concept of the 13th check, which actually gave a little bit of a bump up and then took it down when the investment went dealing with non-performance. And I know we tinkered with that, as is detailed in the history we have before us several times, and I'm not sure, although I probably sponsored most of the tinkerings, you know, and they kind of made sense at this time, but I think figuring out some way that works, if we think it's rational to give some kind of investment bump, is the least harmful way to do that. The other thing that's always puzzled me is one of the problems when we decide, we pick a date that we say these funds have to be fully funded by. And to my mind, that makes sense for closed. It makes absolutely no sense for open funds, because we're always going to have state employees, and we're always going to have teachers and so forth. They may get, you know, they may rise up and down in terms of that, but I've always thought that that puts a constraint that we don't need into the process. And one, and people say, well, you have to just actuarially, you've got to be able to have some goal that you look up at. Why don't we make that a floating year? For example, if it's 30 years, every session that 30 years is calculated from the date that you're computing it. You know, I don't think that should be done all the time. But in the funds that we know, and obviously if a hospital is closing and that kind of, you know, you do get into some problems with that. But the things that we know are going, I mean, no one, not even the worst of these shrinking government people, have suggested that we're not going to have any state employees. No, I'm not. You're practically a Democrat when it comes to issues like that. But so, you know, I'd like us to look at those two things. Is it rational to do a benefit, if we're going to see the, whatever it is, the irrational exuberance of the stock market, is it irrational to have employees participate in that a little bit, but without the deleterious effect that the St. Paul Teachers Fund got into of keeping that? And it seems to me that, as opposed to eliminating it totally, that would be a positive thing. And then the other thing is, let's just either get rid of the date for fully funded or just manipulate it in the way I've suggested. Oh, and then my third question is there any, I know we always think we're better than anybody else, but is there any public pension funds in other states or anywhere that look better than what we're doing, and are there some examples we could look at? I don't know who I'm asking that of, but anybody who knows it.
Well, Madam Chair.
Ms. Hauer.
Regards to Representative Kahn's final question, we do have some data in our report that compares Minnesota's pension plans with those in other states, but I advise you of that cautiously, because the differences among pension plans are so great that making comparisons can be difficult. We do compare, we do make some comparisons with, I think, sufficient cautionary notes included
okay.
that show how our benefits compared and show how some of the structural components of the plans compare. And there are data collected on an annual basis nationwide to make some of those comparisons.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at more of a policy comparison than the actual number comparison, because that can obviously vary for all kinds of reasons. You know, is any no one's come up with a model pension state nationwide model pension policy plan or something like that. Get a congressional medal for doing it. You could do it, Jim. You'll get the congressional medal. Or Jody will get it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as indicated, the action that was taken the last session is rather temporary in its resolution. So will we have the opportunity during the interim to hear from this joint post-fund committee?
I think Mr. Bergstrom's ready to give us a pre-report today. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we ready for that? Come on down. Hand up. Okay, thanks. We get color. We get color. Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Hacking, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
Laurie Hacking with TRA, executive director. I'm going to start off our presentation this morning and deal with a few issues. Let me just say we really appreciate the commission taking time to study these issues because they are very complicated. And it's difficult during the press of the legislative session to give it the attention that some of these issues really need. We have three issues we want to talk to you about today. Two of them are relatively narrow in scope and have to do with actuarial issues. The third is the bigger issue of the post fund that will also update you on our financial status and discuss the work of the post fund committee that the legislative auditor has already referred to. If you could turn to it's the bottom of page one on your handout. Auditor Nobles referred to this issue about actuarial standards needing to change. It is correct that you have passed legislation in the past session to require that your actuarial standards actually conform with GAAP and GASB. But there is an additional action that we believe that you, the commission, have to take, and that is to change your actuarial standards of work. And to that end, we have provided to the committee some draft language for you to consider to actually amend those standards. And that's important that you need to do that because that really has been what our actuaries have been following all these years in terms of determining our financial status, reporting that, and reporting our actuarial valuations. We believe that the market value of the post fund assets should be shown on our financial and actuarial reports. And we'd like to ask you to make this change as soon as possible because the actuaries have already begun work on our valuations for the coming year, and we want this year's valuations to be GAAP and GASB compliant. So we underscore that we would like you to take that action.
And excuse me for interrupting, Ms. Hacking, but I wanted to tell the committee members that we do have this draft in our packet. It's a separate thing that was given by email. Judy Hunt is the name at the top. Okay. Please go on.
Okay. Beyond the actuarial standards of work, we also would urge the commission to update the actuarial assumptions. There were experience studies done for all of our funds. They were completed in 2005, 2006. And in those experience studies, there were recommendations for some changes. We urge you to look at those. There were changes, mostly demographic assumptions, but also economic assumptions, which are far more important and have a significant financial impact on the systems. We also suggest that you hear from the actuary directly about this issue. And in past years, the Pension Commission has routinely heard from the actuary retained to advise you about the financial status of each of our systems. So we would hope at a future meeting, during the interim if possible, that you would invite the actuary to present not only information about the assumption changes that need to be made, but also just a basic report on the financial status of all of our systems. If you turn to the next page, we wanted to give you a snapshot of what our funding status would look like if you make the changes in the actuarial standards of work and also the assumption changes. This chart differs a little bit from what the auditor just showed you because it shows the combined impact of both showing the post-fund deficit and secondly, making some of the economic assumption changes that the actuaries are recommending. So just briefly, I'll go through each column. MSRS is the first column. If all these changes are made, the recognizing the post-fund deficit and the assumption changes, MSRS's general plan funding ratio would stand at 94.7%. Total required contribution rates for that fund is 9.4%, so it would have a slight sufficiency of 0.6% if all of those changes were made. Parageneral, its funding ratio would be 71.9%, required contribution rate of 13%, and it would be pretty much on target to be fully funded in its period, showing no deficiency or sufficiency. And I forgot to mention that the contribution rate increases that you recently enacted for MSRS and PARA are also assumed to be fully implemented in these numbers. For TRA, our financial picture is somewhat different. We would have a funding ratio of 86.8%, required contribution rates of 13.5%, and that would leave TRA with a fairly sizable deficiency of 1.7%. That is significant, and if it persisted, we would likely need contribution rate increases in the future. I want to emphasize that this is fiscal 2006 data. When we have the updated data, these numbers will look better, but we won't have those numbers officially until later in the fall, toward November. We'll certainly provide them as soon as we have them. The next page, the bottom of page 2, shows you the post-fund funding ratio history. Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay. Oh, you have the big copy. I apologize. Okay. Didn't realize that. Page 4. Shows our funding ratio history. Actually, throughout most of the post-fund's history, it has been fairly well-funded. It has been really the last several years' result of the downturn in the markets that we have had a significant deficit. The green line shows the assets of the fund. The red line is the liability of the post fund. As you can see, in 1998, we reached a high point in that fund of 134% funded. That means we had a lot of excess assets. But as the auditor described in their report, we had very large increases in the post fund during that period. So that drove up our liability line. And then in 2001, 2002, we had a very severe market downturn. Post fund went into the red in 2001 at 90, it was 97% funded. We declined significantly to our low point in 2003 with 76% funded and a $5 billion deficit. Now, since then, we have had 4 years of double-digit investment returns, which has been excellent. We had been hoping we could grow out of this post fund deficit, but it is increasingly clear to us that we cannot rely on investment returns to solve this deficit. And that is why you're going to hear in just a minute some of the proposals that our post fund committee is looking at. Over the past few years, turning to page five, it's actually several years, we have been making some strides to try to improve things. We recognized that this was a problem that needed attention. Back in 1999, the joint boards proposed moving from a 5-year to a 10-year smoothing in investment returns. This was 99 was really almost the high point of the markets and the high point of the post-fund increases. That proposal was not acceptable. Quite frankly, we didn't do our work to convince retirees and other constituency groups that this was something that was needed. In 2005, we proposed the 5% cap, and that was adopted last year, enacted in 2006, but won't be effective until 2010. Again, as the auditor said, this protects the fund from future deficits, but it doesn't solve the deficit that we have right now. So in late 2006, we formed a joint board post-fund committee to develop a comprehensive proposal. We've met 7 times. We have at least two more meetings to go. We've established guiding principles, which I'll mention in a moment. But very importantly, we have really reached out to our membership and engaged our members, retirees, and stakeholder groups in the discussion and debate about the post-fund problem. We've tried to inform them about the problem and ask them for their input and reactions to proposals that we're making. We have analyzed upwards of 10 different proposals and approaches to the post-fund problem, and we have settled on one at this point that we think has the most promise, and we'll describe that in a moment. Page 6 just summarizes what our basic principles have been. We've actually got a longer list of principles, but the first and foremost is that we believe that the mechanism needs to provide some inflation protection and reflect the cost of living better than the current mechanism. We also believe that the mechanism should result in more consistent and less volatile increases from year to year. We've had very wide swings in increases, and as you've heard, not very well correlated with inflation. Third, and very important, is that the mechanism needs to be affordable and be financially sustainable, and that is quite a challenge to meet. And last, we would like the increased mechanism to minimize the cost to the plan, particularly for active employees. With that, Dave is going to go over the specifics.
And I'll start on page 7.
And Mr. Bergstrom.
Thank you. The joint committee of the three boards, as Laurie mentioned, has been meeting. What we tried to do is develop a proposal that works in both up markets and down markets. Hence, we have the bullish market showing high investment returns, the post-fund deficit reduced, or the bear market where we have negative returns and the deficit worsens. So we tried to take into account both of those, and we'll go through what would happen in both of those scenarios. First of all, if we continue as we have for the last 4 years and continue to grow out of the deficit, the board or this committee is recommending that we continue the post-fund. What we would do is maintain our inflation component, and I'll go into more detail about this in a few minutes. We would revise our investment component and make it more tied to inflation. We are proposing an inflation equalizer for recent retirees who have not kept up with inflation and have lost some purchasing power. We are proposing to keep the 5% cap that was passed in 06, and we need to establish some mechanism if we get to be 120, 125% funded. More than likely not going to be in my career here, but we will be talking about that anyway. On the other hand, if we end up with negative returns and the post fund, it's clear, will not grow out of its deficit, we don't want to let it continue too long. What we would do at that point is sunset the post fund and merge our active and post fund assets together. I do want to make it clear when we talk about that, we're not talking about merging all three retirement plans. TRA would take back their share of the post fund and add it to their active fund. MSRS would take back their share of the post fund, and PERA would do the same. So we would still have our three separate systems, but we would have just at that point one fund for both active and retired employees. We would propose then that we provide a flat 2.5% increase, not tied to inflation at that point, with the idea that over time it does help keep pace with purchasing power. And then each board would take a couple of years and look at some additional incremental increases above that based on funding and actually look at their whole benefit structure. So, again, we wanted to take into account both scenarios. So if you turn to page 8, and this is if the markets do continue to remain strong and we keep the post fund in place. So this is in the positive scenario. And I'll just do kind of a side-by-side. Under current law, we pay 100% of inflation up to 2.5%. And under our draft, we would continue that same policy. We continue to provide inflation up to 2.5%. Under our current law, once the post fund is 100% funded, we pay additional increases based on investment return. And they could be now as high as an additional 2.5% or even more if inflation was low. So in the past, what we've done is if we've had money, excess money, we'd spread the gains over 5 years and we'd pay it out. So we'd pay it out whether we had inflation or not, and that generated very large increases. What we are proposing to change is that we would replace that investment component with an inflation, additional inflation component. So again, the post fund would have to be over 100% funded. We would have to have excess assets in that post fund, but rather than just paying it because we have it, we would pay it and tie it to inflation. So rather than just paying it out, if inflation, for example, was 3 and we had enough money to pay that additional 0.5%, we would do so. So we'd pay the 2.5% inflation as we do now. If the post fund is fully funded and inflation is higher, we would pay additional inflation protection. So it ties it closer to the rate of inflation. Under both proposals, we would keep the 5% cap on all increases. And under our draft proposal, we are proposing an inflation equalizer, and this is something the auditor's office alluded to. And that would happen in years when inflation is less than 2.5%, and we had returns over 8.5%. That needs to be clarified, that this would only be in years of strong investment return. What we would do in that case, it would provide extra inflation protection to retirees who have lost purchasing power. So let's take an example where inflation was 2% and we had a 10% return. All retirees would get a 2% increase, regardless of when they retired. The retirees who've retired more recently and have fallen behind inflation would get an additional 0.5% inflation protection because they have lagged inflation. So that right now would affect retirees who've retired since 2000. This piece would not require the post fund to be 100% funded. It would require a rate of return in excess of 8.5% and a period of low inflation, but it does provide a mechanism where we would try to bring back those people who have lost purchasing power. The largest purchasing power lost of any of our retiree groups to date is about 3%. So, you know, we've been able to provide a lot of inflation protection through the 2.5%, but there are some groups who have fallen behind inflation. So the scenario under strong market, we'd keep the post fund. We would try to tie increases more to inflation once we are fully funded. If you turn to page 9, the bear comes back. And this would be what we would do in case the markets worsen. And we're referring to this as a safeguard merger. What we would do in this case is try to maintain the financial viability of our programs. We don't want the deficit worsening to a point where we cannot recover from that, and we want to avoid a deficit that becomes unmanageable. So what we will do is establish a funding level at which the post fund would be dissolved. Now, we still need work on doing that, but it would get to the point where we would dissolve it before there's a need for high contribution increases or a point where the funds just are not going to grow out of its problem. So we are referring to that as a safeguard merger, and we just wanted to highlight some of the volatility of the post fund. As Lori said, we've had four wonderful years. We've gone from 76% funded to in the area of 90% funded. However, we asked our actuary to look at what would happen if this coming year, if we started at 90% and we had zero return. Not a negative, but just actually no return for that year. And you could see that we dropped from 90% down to below 84% funded in a one-year period. If we then earn 8.5% on that over time, that post fund would continue to worsen in its deficit. So we've had some great years, but we don't know what's going to happen. I'm not sure if we'll have a bull market. I'm not sure if we'll have a bear market. We tried to develop something that would handle either scenario. On page 11, this is the slide that depicts what we would look like if the post and active funds were combined. Again, the point I want to make here is we would still have our three statewide systems. And even within this, take MSRS, for example, we would have our state patrol plan would be separate, our correctional plan would be separate. So we'd actually still have separate plans underneath that as well. If the post fund is dissolved and joined with our active funds, we would then propose that we pay a fixed 2.5% increase going forward. And then each board can take a couple of years to study their full benefit structure and come back with some proposals at that point. We are doing several things. One is we are trying to develop a minimum funding level at which time the post fund would dissolve. Right now we're at roughly 90%. Would the post fund dissolve at 85%, 88%? 80%. We don't know that. So we're going to come back with some recommendations on that. We also need to look at what would happen if we had great returns and that post fund grew to over 120 or 125% funded. Well, how would that be handled, some of those excess assets? So we will be doing that. The actuary will be modeling some of those conditions for us, various economic scenarios. And we will be able to bring those back probably in the next 2 months. At that point, we hope to have more solid numbers of how our financial status is as of fiscal year 07, and we'll have done this extra modeling. So we are going to further take steps to further refine the proposal. As I already talked to the actuarial analysis we are providing, the actuary is working on that as we speak. We are continuing our committee work. We need to take the feedback we've gotten from the stakeholders. We have sent out newsletters. We've had 60 to 80 individuals at each of our meetings. We did ask the various employee and employer representatives to come in. And also, as part of this proposal, we will be looking at some funding solutions as well as we get more detail as to how we want to proceed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Bergstrom, as you proceed with your studies, I'd be kind of interested in finding out what the active members think about the possible merger of the active and post funds. It would seem to me that one of the arguments that's going to be made is, well, wait a minute, we're only going to do this if the post funds are in trouble, And if I'm an active member, am I going to have to now pay more for a lot of retirees who did not contribute into the fund, and that's why they're in trouble? And so now I'm it's kind of like Social Security. I have to subsidize people who didn't pay in. What's in it for me? Is that, is that what some of the active members might perceive could happen?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that is probably the strongest response that we get from active employees, is they don't want to, I'll just use the word, bail out the post fund.
Okay.
And that is a concern. What I think the response back to that is we have made good progress. If we can stop the deficit from worsening, it will minimize the need for contribution rate increases. So for MSRS, for example, if we're over 85% funded in the post fund, we likely would not need any additional contribution rate. So I think the message we're trying to get to them is, look, if we want to not continue to get into a situation that where the deficit grows, but that will be a concern. I cannot tell you that this proposal is going to be loved by everybody. I think you will find almost everybody has a stake in this one way or the other, and you will hear pros and cons of each. So what our committee tried to do is take into account those needs, try to come up with a proposal that works, and see what happens from there.
Ms. Hacking.
If I may just add to what Dave said, I also think that actives need to feel and have the confidence that the system they're relying on is financially viable into the future. So I think to allow the deficit to worsen and not do something about it is ultimately threatening to active members as well. So I think that's part of the argument, or the part of the discussion that we have to have with actives, that they have a lot at stake in the financial viability of the system.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, and on that point, the chart on page 10 is startling and alarming, and I would think would be a very good illustration of, as difficult as these conversations are, the alternative is worse.
Have you done any of these meetings to a large group? You said 80 people came.
Madam Chair, I think we've had over 80 at some meetings. I think most of the time it's ranged from 60 to 80. We also will be taking the kind of the show to the road, so to speak. I know PERA is planning some town meetings throughout the state. I will be attending our retiree chapter meetings throughout the state. We have retirees and active members throughout the state, so we will be doing that. And I know TRA will be trying to engage their membership as well through regularly scheduled
but
meetings.
The meetings that you've had so far is the meetings of the post committee?
Madam Chair, yes.
Oh, and that's where 80 people come?
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah.
So there is great interest.
Madam Chair, definitely, yes.
Good. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
if I could,
Bergstrom.
On the actuarial standards, the actuaries would like action as soon as possible. I don't know if you're going to have meetings soon or if you're thinking of possibly adopting that today, but the sooner we can get those in compliance with the GASB rules, the better.
And that is in our packet also.
Madam Chair, yes.
This on the second page. And Mr. Martin, to adopt these, what does the commission have to do?
Members, this is a simple administrative action. It's not a recommendation of legislation, so under the commission rules, a simple majority of the quorum can adopt this change.
Okay. And please review for us then what we would be changing from to?
Maybe Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, what we would be changing in standards is the assumption that the post fund is fully funded. When we do our actuarial work right now, we assume the post fund is fully funded, which overstates the value of our assets. We are proposing that the post fund, rather than making that assumption, we just use the market value of the post fund as of that date. So then it would be much more realistic, a realistic measure of what our assets and liabilities would be. So we would show our liabilities as they are and the assets rather as they are, rather than kind of have these make-believe assets that we really do not have.
And this has to be adopted so that you can carry out your recommendations from the post committee. Is my correct?
Madam Chair, it's actually so that our comprehensive annual financial report complies with general accounting standard procedures. So what the auditor alluded to earlier, and I believe is in support of this change, this would put us in compliance with those accounting standards.
Mr. Nobles?
Madam Chair, that's correct, but I would say even more compelling is that this is what the law that you passed requires you to do.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Yep, Madam Chair, I don't know if anybody has any other input on this. If not, I will move the modifications to Section 2 of the LCPR actuarial standards.
Is there any further discussion? If not, all in favor of the Betzold motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to give testimony about the legislative auditor's report or anything that Mr. Bergstrom talked about? Please. Hello,
folks,
welcome.
You don't know me, but I know you because I watch you almost every day when you're in session. And I'm a retired public lawyer, and my name is Floyd Olson.
Oh.
And I wrote each of you a letter in which I expressed my concerns, and I have also attended all of the meetings of the Post Fund. I have reviewed all of the material of the legislative auditor with whom I agree almost completely. And what I wanted to suggest and at least put on the oral record is that I think, and I may be wrong, but I think that by adopting what you've just adopted, or by the legislature adopting the government accounting standards, I think that it's very possible that as soon as the auditors come in, you will have merged the funds anyway because the deficit will then be larger. And it may pass the threshold that the post fund is recommending for merger. And that was a question that I had. It just seemed to me that that might happen. And so that's why in my letter I suggested a merger of the funds. And I'm also cognizant of the fact that it might meet with a great deal of opposition from those who've contributed more and those who for the last several years have not received sufficient public salary increases in the state employees, which tends to lower their high five. So what I think here is that what I am suggesting here is a solution to the problem My first impulse was to be very angry with what took place, because I know, and I know that the legislators know, that there was legal advice given to them that suggested that the 2006 law, which limited the investment portion to 2.5%, was somewhat legally questionable. I also will tell you that, as far as I'm concerned, the so-called 5% that the post fund folks always allude to is not a 5%, because they have also indicated to you and to everyone else that the deficit will not be made up for 12 to 15 years, if ever. The result is that what they have is a 2.5% increase, inflationary increase. And that 2.5%, according to my review of the last 25 years of inflationary figures or cost of living figures that was produced by the Minneapolis or the Minnesota Federal Reserve, was it averaged over 25 years 3.22%. Now, 2.5% for the next 12 or 15 years is not, in my opinion, an enhanced inflationary figure. Now, the problem, you have a political problem here, of course, and I'm not here to tell you how to solve your political problems. I never was a politician. Don't pretend to be one. Don't have any interest in running for public office. But I think that the legislative auditor is right on target when he says that the investment portion, which is retained with a cap of 2.5% by the folks in the post fund committee, I think that that really retains the investment part of the fund. There isn't any reason to do that. As the legislative auditor has said, I'll say it more directly, I think that the fund that had the investment, that gave an investment formula that provided all of us who are retirees, and I'm one of the beneficiaries, I think it was a disaster on its face. I think that it started out as a disaster, but I appreciate the politics. The other thing I'd like to say is that one way to get a sufficient trade-offs is to forget about the investment portion of the formula, increase the inflationary formula to 3.5%, a cap of 3.5%. That amount would more closely resemble the last 25-year average, be an amount not to exceed for older retirees, and then I think the trade-off for the folks who are recent retirees will be, as the post fund has suggested, a look-back feature, which gives them a little bit more. After all, they're paying more in contributions. And this was my solution as I listened to the post fund people talk about this and as I read the legislative report. So what I think it does is combines features of both. And as you know, Franklin Roosevelt had economic advisors, one who was very conservative and one who was very liberal. And they used to fight constantly over which one they should adopt. And Franklin Roosevelt said, I'm going to take the best parts of both. And that was his approach to it. And I would suggest that you probably look at that. And I thank you for the opportunity to sound off here to you. I'm here representing myself and my wife, whom I am more concerned about, because I can get by on what I'm making now, on what I'm getting on a pension. I'm not objecting to the pension. But my wife is considerably younger than I am, and I suspect as my survivor that if you apply a 2.5% cap, that she may just not have enough money to pay the assisted living folks off when I'm long gone. And I think you ought to take a long view of it rather than a short-term political view of it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. When you were talking merger, you were talking in the same vein that Mr. Bergstrom was talking about merging,
yes,
right?
As I understand it.
The post-bond with the active fund.
Right, and as I understand it, it's going to be down in the 60% level as soon as the actuaries determine what the market value is. Unless I'm mistaken, under the formula that the post-fund people are developing, the sunset provision, it happens right then. And it seems to me to make absolutely no sense. I think it's kind of a convoluted way to achieve what you're going to have to do anyway.
Thank you for your advice.
Thank you.
Mr. Laurel?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, we were not anticipating that there would be a discussion about the proposal before the Post Fund Committee at this meeting. And it is an issue that we have and our new leadership has been discussing at length very recently. In fact, our new president is scheduled to speak before the TRA board tomorrow morning, and this was one of the issues he plans to touch on. To give you...
And there will be other opportunities before this commission also.
Yes, and my comments are very brief. Really, one of the issues that we are discussing at length is one that Senator Betzholder brought up, is that if there is a merger of the post and active funds, the deficit from the post fund becomes merged or assumed by the new, basically the TRA active fund, and into a new merged fund. The deficit doesn't disappear. It is just adopted by the larger fund. If the next step in this reasoning process would be for some kind of contribution increase to address the deficit, and there are only a limited number of sources of new money, the state, direct or indirect, or contributions from the employee. Our active younger members who do not have the rule of 90 would then be faced, possibly in the future, with a contribution rate increase. So not only do they not have the benefit that some of the more veteran members have, but they would be asked to pay for the deficit created in part by some of the retirees. And that we are very concerned about. We have not come out with an official position at this point, and perhaps maybe by tomorrow, since things are speeding up, there will be one. But I wanted you to keep that in mind, that is something of much concern. The other thing that I would mention is that as the books close for the investment year at the end of June, for the past previous year, the returns, market returns, as the legislative auditor mentioned, have been in the double-digit category. So nothing that has happened since then in terms of market volatility and stock market really impacts what's on the books. And by the end of the year, we may have market returns that are maybe not double digit, but certainly good ones. We simply do not know. What we do know as of this point is that we've had a very good year, a very, very good past 4 years, and that has led to an even healthier post and active fund. So I think Representative Kahn alluded to keeping a different perspective on public pension funds public pension funds being a long-term institution, that we ought to make the decisions based on what we see in the very long term and not, you know, even for the what we see happening in the present, past week, next year, or even 2 or 3 years from now, but really looking at a 30 or 50 year out into the future and what's better for our members, both active and retired. Appreciate this opportunity, and we really appreciate the work you're doing, because the livelihood of a lot of people will depend on your decision. So thank you very much.
Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Hackey. Mm-hmm. Just for further clarification, please. And what you're presenting in your show that's going on the road, so to speak. What you're really emphasizing is the recommendations from the post fund and what you hope your recommendations will do to keep the post fund stable and correct the problems with it, so that there wouldn't have to be a merger. But being responsible as you are, you have a plan for the merger if it ever came to be. But in the immediate future, you're not proposing the merger from the post fund to the merging of the post and the active funds. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, you are correct.
Okay.
The plan would be to let the post fund grow out, and if not, we would then merge. And Mr. Olson, I do think, misunderstood a little bit. The accounting change we talked about, our post fund, we still will account for separately, and that will be in the 90 to 91% funded ratio. So that accounting error will not overnight abolish the post fund.
And Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Hacking, do you have any idea of the number of years before it would be that you would put your proposed merger plan in action if things keep on being bad?
Madam Chair, not yet. That's what our actuary is helping us determine at this point. So what we will do is come back with some recommendations as to when it would merge and when it would not merge. Would it be if it fell below 1 year or 2 years? We have a lot of soul searching to do yet before we get there.
But in order to start and to continue to be responsible, you are taking the proposal out on the road. And people are going to hear about it.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We are going to tell people. We've asked for comments. We've gotten hundreds. Inevitably, whatever we propose is going to come here. Mm-hmm. And you will hear some of the same comments that we have heard as well. And we're really just trying to put together a recommendation. Our boards are trying to put a recommendation to you that covers us under either of the economic scenarios.
But the thrust that you are most hopeful about is that the post fund will continue and improve.
Madam Chair, yes. That would be a wonderful thing.
I think that would be a wonderful thing, too. Go forth and do good work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to comment on anything? Please come in forward, Mr. Kapler.
Madam Chair, members, Phil Kapler from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. I'm going to be very, very brief, just following up on the comments made by the legislative auditor. And just to remind you, kind of catch us up, last session we did get partway to implementing the recommendations brought forward by the auditor. We did modify the for St. Paul teachers, and we don't know what the effect of that is going to be yet, but
we have a pilot,
right? And we think there's going to be significant savings, but that pilot is set up for 2 years. The only mildly lamentable thing about the outcome with regard to that is that we still have an investment related trigger, which I think Mr. Nobles did an extremely good job of arguing for, and which was part of our original proposal, was to completely decouple post-retirement increases from investment gains or losses and hold the retirees relatively harmless against inflation to the extent that you can within fiscal bounds. And at the end of 2 years, we may need to reevaluate that. And just as a sort of additional parenthetical, we did request additional funding last year in the amount, an additional net of about $5.4 million in that bill in supplemental state funding. And state funding was requested because our members and our sponsoring employer unit have been making normal cost for some time, and contribution rates still have not been sufficient to fund the plan, and that's just because we're carrying forward a very large historical deficit, and we will be back seeking some assistance on that. And I just wanted to make sure that we made note of that, because I think Edmund's point on what, you know, might be needed to supplement the funds if there's a merger of the post and the active funds may be valid. But St. Paul was here last year, and we took a number and had our seat first, and I didn't want that to get lost in a shuffle for these large fiscal issue discussions. Thank you.
Thank you for that reminder. Anyone else? If not, if not, if you have any ideas on when the September meeting and the next September meeting should take place, or shouldn't take place, forward those dates to Lisa Dieselin. Because I know we don't know a lot of things about September, but we are going to have to set a meeting soon. And not, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you for coming. Is there someone from PERA here? Okay. Could I see you for a moment, please? Dave. Couldn't remember his name. I didn't know what he
was. It's a J, not a U, but I think the House would probably come up with a couple of the people that they just want to talk to.